Asgard, and it's the lad who sits the chair, not you. Rhaegar Baratheon bristled at Ser Samgood's words and answered, You are seven. I have 600 swords behind me. A word from me and they will cut you to pieces. They might kill us, replied young Pate the woodcock, brandishing his spear. But you will be the first to die, my lord. You have my word upon that. What might have happened next, no man can say, had not Queen Alyssa chosen that moment to speak. I have seen enough death, she said. So have we all. Put up your swords, Sirs. What is done, and now we all must needs live with it. May the gods have mercy on the realm. She turned to her children. We shall go in peace. Let no man speak of what happened here today. As you command, mother, King Jaehaerys pulled his sister closer and put his arm around her. But do not think that you shall unmake this marriage. We are one now, and neither gods nor men shall part us. Never, his bride affirmed. Send me to the ends of the earth and wed me to the King of Mossovy or the Lord of the Grey Waste. Silverwing will always bring me back to Jaehaerys. And with that she raised herself onto her toes and lifted her face to the king, and he kissed her full upon the lips, whilst all looked on. Also the confrontation at the gates of Dragonstone was set down by Grand Maester Bennifer, who was there to witness it. From that day to this, the tale has been a favourite of lovesick maidens and their squires throughout the Seven Kingdoms, and many a bard has sung of the valour of the King's Guard, seven men in white cloaks who faced down 600. All of these tellings overlook the presence of the castle garrison, however. Such records as have come down to us indicate that 20 archers and as many guardsmen were stationed on Dragonstone at this time, under the command of Ser Meryl Bullock and his sons Alan and Howard. Where their loyalties lay at this time and what part they might have played in any conflict shall never be known. But to suggest the King's Seven stood alone mayhaps presumes too much. When the Hand and the Queen Regent had made their departure, the King and his young bride closed the castle gates and returned to their chambers. Dragonstone would remain their refuge and their residence for the remainder of Jaehaerys's minority. It is written that the young king and queen were seldom apart during that time, sharing every meal, talking late into the night of the green days of their childhood and the challenges ahead, fishing and hawking together, mingling with the island's small folk in dockside inns, reading to one another from dusty, leather-bound tomes they found in the castle library, taking lessons together from Dragonstone's maesters, for we still have much to learn, Alysanne is said to have reminded her husband, praying beside Septon Oswick. They flew together as well, all around the Dragonmont and oft as far as Driftmark. If servants' tales may be believed, the king and his new queen slept naked and shared many long and lingering kisses, abed and at table, and at many other times throughout the day, yet never consummated their union. Another year and a half would pass before Jaehaerys and Alysanne would finally join as man and woman. Whenever lords and council members travelled to Dragonstone to consult with the young king, as they did from time to time, Jaehaerys received them in the chamber of the painted table, where his grandsire had once planned his conquest of Westeros, with Alysanne ever by his side. Aegon had no secrets from Rhaenys and Visenya, and I have none from Alysanne, he said. Though it might well have been that there were no secrets between them during these bright days in the morning of the marriage, their union itself remained a secret to most of Westeros. Upon their return to King's Landing, Lord Rhaegar instructed all those who had accompanied them to Dragonstone to speak no word of what had transpired there, if they wished to keep their tongues. Nor was there any announcement made to the realm at large. When Septon Mateus attempted to send word of the match to the High Septon and most devout in Old Town, Grand Maester Bennifer burned his letter, rather than dispatch a raven, on orders from the Hand. The Lord of Storm's End wanted time. Angry at the disrespect he felt the king had shown him, and unaccustomed to defeat, Rhaegar Baratheon remained determined to find a way to part Jaehaerys and Alysanne. So long as their marriage remained unconsummated, he believed, a chance remained. Best, then, to keep the wedding secret so it might be undone without anyone being the wiser. Queen Alyssa wanted time as well, though for a different reason. "What is done," she had said at the gates of Dragonstone, and so she believed. But memories of the bloodshed and chaos that had greeted the marriage of her other son and daughter still haunted her nights, and the Queen Regent was desperate to find some way to ascertain that history would not be repeated. Meanwhile, she and her lord husband still had a realm to rule for the best part of a year, until Jaehaerys attained his 16th name day and took the power into his own hands. And so matters stood in Westeros as the year of the three brides grew to an end and gave way to a new year, the 50th since Aegon's conquest. A Surfeit of Rulers. All men are sinners, the fathers of the faith teach us. Even the noblest of kings and the most chivalrous of knights may find themselves overcome by rage and lust and envy, and commit acts that shame them and tarnish their good names. And the vilest of men and the wickedest of women likewise may do good from time to time, for love and compassion and pity may be found in even the blackest of hearts. "We are as the gods made us," wrote Septon Barth, the wisest man ever to serve as the hand of the king. "Strong and weak, good and bad, cruel and kind, heroic and selfish. Know that, if you would rule over the kingdoms of men." Seldom was the truth of his words seen as clearly as during the 50th year after Aegon's conquest. As the new year dawned, all across the realm plans were being made to mark a half-century of Targaryen rule over Westeros, with feasts, fairs, and tourneys. The horrors of King Maegor's rule were receding into the past. The Iron Throne and the Faith were reconciled, and the young King Jaehaerys I was the darling of small folk and great lords alike, from Old Town to the Wall. Yet unbeknownst to all but a few, storm clouds were gathering on the horizon, and faintly in the distance wise men could hear a rumble of thunder. "A realm with two kings is like a man with two heads," the small folk are wont to say. In 50 AC, the realm of Westeros found itself blessed with one king, a hand, and three queens, as in King Maegor's day. But whereas Maegor's queens had been consorts, subservient to his will, living and dying at his whim, each of the queens of the half-century was a power in her own right. In the Red Keep of King's Landing sat the Queen Regent Alyssa, widow of the late King Aenys, mother to his son Jaehaerys, and wife to the King's Hand, Rhaegar Baratheon. Just across Blackwater Bay on Dragonstone, a younger queen had arisen when Alyssa's daughter Alysanne, a maid of 13 years, had pledged her troth to her brother King Jaehaerys, against the wishes of her mother and her mother's lord husband. And far to the west on Fair Isle, with the whole width of Westeros separating her from both mother and sister, was Alyssa's eldest daughter, the dragon rider Rhaenyra Targaryen, widow of Prince Aegon the Uncrowned. In the Westerlands, Riverlands, and parts of the Reach, men were already calling her the Queen in the West. Two sisters and a mother, the three queens were bound by blood and grief and suffering, and yet between them lay shadows, old and new, growing darker by the day. The amity and unity of purpose that had enabled Jaehaerys, his sisters and their mother, to topple Maegor the Cruel had begun to fray, as long-simmering resentments and divisions made themselves felt. For the remainder of the regency, the boy king and his little queen would find themselves deeply at odds with the king's hand and the queen regent, in a rivalry that would continue into Jaehaerys' own reign and threaten to plunge the Seven Kingdoms back into war. It should be noted, lest we be charged with omission, that there was a fourth queen in Westeros in 50 AC, the twice-widowed Queen Eleanor of House Costain, who had found King Maegor dead upon the Iron Throne, had departed King's Landing after Jaehaerys' ascent, dressed in the robes of a penitent, and accompanied only by a handmaid and one leal man-at-arms. She made her way to the Eyrie in the Vale of Arryn to visit the eldest of her three sons by Sir Theo Bolling, and thence to Highgarden in the Reach, where her second son had been fostered to Lord Tyrell. Once satisfied of their well-being, the former queen reclaimed her youngest boy and repaired to her father's seat at Three Towers in the Reach, where she declared she would live quietly for the remainder of her life. Fate and King Jaehaerys had other plans for her, as we shall relate later. Suffice it to say that Queen Eleanor played no role in the events of 50 AC. The immediate cause of the tension was the king's sudden and secret marriage to his sister, which had taken the hand and the queen regent unawares, and thrown their own plans and schemes into disarray. It would be a mistake to believe that was the sole cause of the estrangement, however. The other weddings that had made 49 AC the Year of the Three Brides had also left scars. Lord Rhaegar had never asked Jaehaerys for leave to wed his mother, an omission the boy king took for a sign of disrespect. Moreover, his grace did not approve of the match. As he would later confess to Septon Barth, he valued Lord Rhaegar as a counsellor and friend, but he did not need a second father, and thought his own judgment, temperament, and intelligence to be superior to his hands. Jaehaerys also felt he should have been consulted about his sister Rhaenyra's marriage, though he felt that slight less keenly. Queen Alyssa, for her part, was deeply hurt that she had neither been advised of nor invited to Rhaenyra's wedding on Fair Isle. Away in the west, Rhaenyra Targaryen nursed her own grievances. As she confided to the old friends and favourites she had gathered around her, Queen Rhaenyra neither understood nor shared her mother's affection for Rhaegar Baratheon. Though she honoured him grudgingly for rising in support of her brother Jaehaerys against their uncle Maegor, his inaction when her own husband, Prince Aegon, faced Maegor in the battle beneath the god's eye was something she could neither forget nor forgive. Also, with the passage of time, Queen Rhaenyra grew ever more resentful that her own claim to the Iron Throne, and that of her daughters, had been disregarded in favour of that of my baby brother, as she was wont to call Jaehaerys. She was the firstborn, she reminded those who would listen, and had been a dragon rider before any of her siblings, yet all of them, and even my own mother, had conspired to pass her over. Looking back now with the benefit of hindsight, it is easy to say that Jaehaerys and Alysanne had the right of it in the conflicts that arose during the last year of their mother's regency, and to cast Queen Alyssa and Lord Rhaegar as villains. That is how the singers tell the tale, certainly. The swift and sudden marriage of Jaehaerys and Alysanne was a romance unequalled since the days of Florian the Fool and his Jonquil, to hear them sing of it. And in songs as ever, love conquers all. The truth, we submit, is a deal less simple. Queen Alyssa's misgivings about the match grew out of genuine concern for her children, the Targaryen dynasty, and the realm as a whole. Nor were her fears without foundation. Lord Rhaegar Baratheon's motives were less selfless. A proud man, he had been stunned and angered by the ingratitude of the boy king he had regarded as a son, and humiliated when forced to back down at the gates of Dragonstone before 50 of his men. A warrior to the bone, Rhaegar had once dreamed of facing Maegor the Cruel in single combat, and could not stomach being shamed by a lad of 15 years. Lest we think too harshly of him, however, we would do well to remember Septon Barth's words. Though he would do some cruel, foolish, and evil things during his last year as hand, he was not a cruel or evil man at heart, nor even a fool. He had been a hero once, and we must remember that even as we look at the darkest year of his life. In the immediate aftermath of his confrontation with Jaehaerys, Lord Rhaegar could think of little else but the humiliation he had suffered. His lordship's first impulse was to return to Dragonstone with more men, enough to overwhelm the castle garrison and resolve the situation by force. As for the King's Guard, Lord Rhaegar reminded the council that the White Swords had sworn to lay down their lives for the king, and I shall be pleased to give them that honour. When Lord Tully pointed out that Jaehaerys could simply close the gates of Dragonstone against them, Lord Rhaegar was undeterred. Let him! I can take the castle by storm if need be. In the end, only Queen Alyssa could reach his lordship through his wrath and dissuade him from this folly. My love, she said softly, my children ride dragons. and we do not. The Queen Regent, no less than her husband, wished to have the King's rash marriage undone, for she was convinced that word of it would once again set the faith against the crown. Her fears were fanned by Septon Mateus. Once away from Jeheris, and secure in the knowledge that his lips would not be sewn shut, the Septon found his tongue again, and spoke of little else but how all decent folk would condemn the king's incestuous union. Had Jeheris and Alisan returned to King's Landing in time to celebrate the new year, as Queen Alyssa prayed, they will come to their senses and repent this folly, she told the council. Reconciliation might have been possible. But that did not happen. When a fortnight came and went, and then another, and still the king did not reappear at court, Alyssa announced her intention to return to Dragonstone, this time alone, to beg her children to come home. Lord Rogar angrily forbade it. "If you go crawling back to him, the boy will never listen to you again," he said. "He has put his own desires ahead of the good of the realm, and that cannot be allowed. Do you want him to end as his father did?" And so the queen bent to his will, and did not go. That Queen Alyssa wished to do the right thing no man should doubt, Septon Barth wrote years later. Sad to say, however, she oft seemed at a loss as to what that thing might be. She desired above all to be loved, admired, and praised, a yearning she shared with King Aenys, her first husband. A ruler must sometimes do things that are necessary but unpopular, however, though he knows that opprobrium and censure must surely follow. These things Queen Alyssa could seldom bring herself to do. Days passed and turned to weeks, and thence to fortnights, whilst hearts hardened and men grew more resolute on both sides of Blackwater Bay. The boy king and his little queen remained on Dragonstone, awaiting the day when Jeheris would take the rule of the Seven Kingdoms in his own hands. Queen Alyssa and Lord Rogar continued to hold the reins of power in King's Landing, searching for a way to undo the king's marriage and avert the calamity they were certain was to come. Aside from the council, they told no one of what had transpired on Dragonstone, and Lord Rogar commanded the men who had accompanied them to speak no word of what they had seen, at the penalty of losing their tongues. Once the marriage had been annulled, his lordship reasoned, it would be as if it had never happened, so far as most of Westeros was concerned, so long as it remained secret. Until the union was consummated, it could still easily be set aside. This would prove to be a vain hope, as we know now, but to Rogar Baratheon in 50 AC it seemed possible. For a time he must surely have drawn encouragement from the king's own silence. Jeheris had moved swiftly to marry Alisan, but having done the deed he seemed in no great haste to announce it. He certainly had the means to do so, had he so desired. Maester Caliper, still spry at 80, had been serving since Queen Visenya's day and was ably assisted by two younger maesters. Dragonstone had a full complement of ravens. At a word from Jeheris, his marriage could have been proclaimed from one end of the realm to the other. He did not speak that word. Scholars have debated ever since as to the reasons for his silence. Was he repenting a match, made in haste as Queen Alyssa would have wished? Had Alisan somehow offended him? Had he grown fearful of the realm's response to the marriage, recalling all that had befallen Aegon and Rhaena? Was it possible that Septon Mateus's dire prophecies had shaken him more than he cared to admit? Or was he simply a boy of 15 who had acted rashly with no thought to the consequences, only to find himself now at a loss as to how to proceed? Arguments can and have been made for all these explanations, but in light of what we know now about Jeheris the First Targaryen, they ultimately ring hollow. Young or old, this was a king who never acted without thinking. To this writer it seems plain that Jeheris was not repenting his marriage and had no intention of undoing it. He had chosen the queen he wanted and would make the realm aware of that in due course, but at a time of his own choosing, in a manner best calculated to lead to acceptance. When he was a man grown and a king ruling in his own right, not a boy who had wed in defiance of his regent's wishes. The young king's absence from court did not go unnoticed for long. The ashes of the bonfires lit in celebration of the new year had scarce grown cold before the people of King's Landing began asking questions. To curtail the rumours, Queen Elissa put out word that His Grace was resting and reflecting on Dragonstone, the ancient seat of his house. But as more time passed, with still no sign of Jaehaerys, lords and small folk alike began to wonder. Was the king ill? Had he been made a prisoner for reasons yet unknown? The personable and handsome boy king had moved amongst the people of King's Landing so freely, seemingly delighting in mingling with them, that this sudden disappearance seemed unlike him. Queen Alysanne, for her part, was in no haste to return to court. "Here I have you to myself, day and night," she told Jaehaerys. "When we go back, I shall be fortunate to snatch an hour with you, for every man in Westeros will want a piece of you." For her, these days on Dragonstone were an idyll. Many years from now, when we are old and grey, we shall look back upon these days and smile, remembering how happy we were. Jaehaerys himself no doubt shared some of these sentiments, but the young king had other reasons for remaining on Dragonstone. Unlike his uncle Maegor, he was not prone to bursts of rage, but he was more than capable of anger, and he would never forget nor forgive his deliberate exclusion from the council meetings wherein his marriage and that of his sister were being discussed. And whilst he would always remain grateful to Rhaegar Baratheon for helping him to the Iron Throne, Jaehaerys did not intend to be ruled by him. "I had one father," he said to Maester Caliper during those days on Dragonstone. "I do not require a second." The king recognized and appreciated the virtues of the hand, but he was aware of his flaws as well, flaws that had become very apparent in the days leading up to the Golden Wedding, when Jaehaerys himself had sat in audience with the lords of the realm, whilst Lord Rhaegar was hunting, drinking, and deflowering maidens. Jaehaerys was aware of his own shortcomings, too, shortcomings he intended to rectify before he sat the Iron Throne. His father, King Aenys, had been slighted as weak, in part because he was not the warrior that his brother Maegor was. Jaehaerys was determined that no man would ever question his own courage or skill at arms. On Dragonstone he had Ser Meryl Bullock, commander of the castle garrison, his sons, Ser Alyn and Ser Howard, a seasoned master-at-arms in Ser Elias Scales, and his own seven, the finest fighters in the realm. Every morning Jaehaerys trained with them in the castle yard, shouting at them to come at him harder, to press him, harry him, and attack him in every way they knew. From sunrise till noon he worked with them, honing his skills with sword and spear and mace and axe, whilst his new queen looked on. It was a hard and brutal regimen. Each bout ended only when the king himself or his opponent declared him dead. Jaehaerys died so often that the men of the garrison made a game of it, shouting, "The king is dead!" every time he fell, and "Long live the king!" when he struggled to his feet. His foes began a contest, wagering with one another to see which of them could kill the king the most. The victor, we are told, was young Ser Pate the Woodcock, whose darting spear purportedly gave his grace fits. Jaehaerys was oft bruised and bloody by evening, to Alysanne's distress, but his prowess improved so markedly that near the end of his time on Dragonstone, old Ser Elias himself told him, "Your Grace, you will never be a king's guard. But if by some sorcery or Uncle Maegor himself were to rise from the grave, my coin would be on you." One evening, after a day in which Jaehaerys had been severely tested and battered, Maester Caliper said to him, "Your Grace, why do you punish yourself so harshly? The realm is at peace." The young king only smiled and replied, "The realm was at peace when my grandsire died, but scarcely had my father climbed onto the throne than foes rose up on every side. They were testing him to learn if he was strong or weak. They will test me as well." He was not wrong, though his first trial, when it came, was to be of a very different nature, one that no amount of training in the yards of Dragonstone could possibly have prepared him for. For it was his worth as a man and his love for his little queen that were to be put to the test. We know very little about the childhood of Alysanne Targaryen. As the fifth-born child of King Aenys and Queen Alyssa, and a female, observers at court found her of less interest than her older siblings, who stood higher in the line of succession. From what little has come down to us, Alysanne was a bright but unremarkable girl, small but never sickly, courteous, biddable, with a sweet smile and a pleasing voice. To the relief of her parents, she displayed none of the timidity that had afflicted her elder sister Rhaena as a small child. Neither did she exhibit the wilful and stubborn temperament of Rhaena's daughter Arya. As a princess of the royal household, Alysanne would of course have had servants and companions from an early age. As an infant, certainly, she would have had a wet nurse. Like most noble women, Queen Alyssa did not give suck to her own children. Later, a maester would have taught her to read and write and do sums, and a scepter would have instructed her in piety, deportment, and the mysteries of the faith. Girls of common birth would have served as her maids, washing her clothing and emptying her chamber pot, and in good time she would certainly have taken ladies of a like age and noble blood as companions, to ride and play and sew with. Alysanne did not choose these companions for herself. They were selected for her by her mother, Queen Alyssa, and they came and went with some frequency, to ascertain that the princess did not grow too fond of any of them. Her sister Rhaena's penchant for showering an unseemly amount of affection and attention on a succession of favourites, some of whom were considered less than suitable, had been the source of much whispering at court, and the queen did not want Alysanne to be the subject of similar rumours. All this changed when King Aenys died on Dragonstone and his brother, Maegor, returned from across the Narrow Sea to seize the Iron Throne. The new king had little love and less trust for any of his brother's children, and he had his mother, the Dowager Queen Visenya, to enforce his will. Queen Alyssa's household knights and servants were dismissed, together with the servants and companions of her children, and Jaehaerys and Alysanne were made wards of their great-aunt, the fearsome Visenya. Hostages in all but name, they spent their uncle's reign being shuttled between Driftmark, Dragonstone, and King's Landing at the will of others, until Visenya's death in 44 AC offered Queen Alyssa an opportunity to escape, a chance she seized with alacrity, fleeing Dragonstone with Jaehaerys, Alysanne, and the Blade Dark Sister. No reliable accounts of Princess Alysanne's life after the escape survive to this day. She does not appear again in the annals of the realm until the final days of Maegor's bloody reign, when her mother and Lord Rhaegar rode forth from Storm's End at the head of an army, whilst Alysanne, Jaehaerys, and their sister Rhaena descended on King's Landing with their dragons. Undoubtedly, Princess Alysanne had handmaids and companions in the days that followed Maegor's death. Their names and particulars have not come down to us, unfortunately. We do know that none of them came with the princess when she and Jaehaerys fled the Red Keep on their dragons. Aside from the seven knights of the king's guard and the castle garrison, cooks, stable hands and other servants, the king and his bride were unattended on Dragonstone. That was hardly proper for a princess, let alone for a queen. Alysanne must have her household, and in that her mother Alyssa saw an opportunity to undermine and mayhaps undo her marriage. The Queen Regent resolved to dispatch to Dragonstone a carefully selected company of companions and servants to see to the young Queen's needs. The plan, Grand Maester Bennifer assures us, was Queen Alyssa's. But it was one that Lord Rhaegar assented to gladly, for he saw at once a way to twist it to his own ends. The aged Septon Oswick, who had performed the wedding rites for Jaehaerys and Alysanne, kept the sept on Dragonstone, but a young lady of royal birth required one of her own sex to see to her religious instruction. Queen Alyssa sent three, the formidable scepter Isabel, and two well-born novices of Alysanne's own age, Lyra and Edith. To take charge of the serving girls and maids of Alysanne's household, she dispatched Lady Lucinda Tully, the wife of the Lord of Riverrun, whose fierce piety was renowned through all the land. With her came her younger sister, Ella, of House Broom, a modest maid whose name had briefly been offered as a match for Jaehaerys. Lord Celtigar's daughters, so recently scorned by the Hand as being chinless, breastless, and witless, were included as well. "We had as well get some use of them," Lord Rogar supposedly told their father. Three other girls of noble birth made up the remainder of the company, one each from the Vale, the Stormlands, and the Reach: Jennis of House Templeton, Corianne of House Wild, and Rosamond of House Ball. Queen Elisa wanted her daughter attended by suitable companions of her own age and station, no doubt, but that was not her sole motivation in sending these ladies to Dragonstone. Scepter Isabel, and the novices Edith and Lyra, and the deeply pious Lady Lucinda and her sister had a further charge. It was the hope of the Queen Regent that these fiercely righteous women might impress upon Alisan, and mayhaps even Jaehaerys, that for brother to lie with sister was an abomination in the eyes of the faith. The children, as Elisa persisted in calling the king and queen, were not evil, only young and wilful. Suitably instructed, they might see the error of their ways and repent their marriage before it tore the realm apart. Or so she prayed. Lord Rogar's motives were baser. Unable to rely on the loyalty of the castle garrison or the knights of the king's guard, the Hand needed eyes and ears on Dragonstone. All that Jaehaerys and Alisan said and did was to be reported back to him, he made clear to Lady Lucinda and the others. He was especially anxious to learn if and when the king and queen intended on consummating their marriage. That, he stressed, must be prevented. And mayhaps there was more. And now, unfortunately, we must give some consideration to a certain distasteful book that first appeared in the Seven Kingdoms some 40 years after the events presently being discussed. Copies of this book still pass from hand to hand in the low places of Westeros, and may oft be found in certain brothels, those catering to patrons able to read, and the libraries of men of low morals, where they are best kept under lock and key, hidden from the eyes of maidens, goodwives, children, and the chaste and pious. The book in question is known under various titles, amongst them Sins of the Flesh, The High and the Low, A Wanton's Tale, and The Wickedness of Men, but all versions bear the subtitle A Caution for Young Girls. It purports to be the testimony of a young maid of noble birth who surrendered her virtue to a groom in her lord father's castle, gave birth to a child out of wedlock, and thereafter found herself partaking of every sort of wickedness imaginable during a long life of sin, suffering, and slavery. If the author's tale is true, parts of it strain credulity, during the course of her life she found herself a handmaid to a queen, the paramour of a young knight, a camp follower in the disputed lands of Essos, a serving wench in Myr, a mummer in Tyrosh, the plaything of a corsair queen in the Basilisk Isles, a slave in old Volantis, where she was tattooed, pierced, and ringed, the handmaid of a Carthene warlock, and finally, the mistress of a pleasure house in Lys, before ultimately returning to Old Town and the Faith. Purportedly, she ended her life as a scepter in the Starry Sept, where she set down this story of her life to warn other young maids not to do as she had done. The lascivious details of the author's erotic adventures need not concern us here. Our only interest is in the early part of her sordid tale, the story of her youth. For the alleged author of A Caution for Young Girls is none other than Corianne Wilde, one of the girls sent to Dragonstone as a companion to the little queen. We have no way to ascertain the veracity of her story, nor even whether she was in truth the author of this infamous book. Some argue plausibly that the text is the product of several hands, for the style of the prose varies greatly from episode to episode. Lady Corianne's early history, however, is confirmed in the accounts of the maester who served at the Rain House during her youth. At the age of 13, he records, Lord Wilde's younger daughter was indeed seduced and deflowered by a surly lad from the stables. In A Caution for Young Girls, this lad is described as a handsome boy her own age, but the maester's account differs, painting the seducer as a pox-scarred varlet of 30 years, distinguished only by a male member as stout as a stallion's. Whatever the truth, the surly lad was gelded and sent to the wall as soon as his deed was known, whilst Lady Corianne was confined to her chambers to give birth to his base-born son. The boy was sent away soon after birth to Storm's End, where he would be fostered by one of the castle stewards and his barren wife. The bastard boy was born in 48 AC, according to the Maester's journals. Lady Corianne was carefully watched afterward, but few beyond the walls of the Rain House knew of her shame. When the raven came to summon her to King's Landing, her lady mother told her sternly that she was never to speak of her child or her sin. In the Red Keep they will take you for a maiden. But as the girl made her way to the city, escorted by her father and a brother, they stopped for the night at an inn on the south bank of the Blackwater Rush beside the ferry landing. There she found a certain great lord awaiting her arrival. And here the tale grows even more tangled, for the identity of the man at the inn is a matter of some dispute, even amongst those who accept a caution for young girls to contain a modicum of truth. Over the years and centuries, as the book was copied and recopied, many changes and emendations crept into the text. The maesters who labour at the Citadel copying books are rigorously trained to reproduce the original word for word, but few mundane scribes are so disciplined. Such septons, scepters, and holy sisters as copy and illuminate books for the faith oft strike out or alter any passages they believe to be offensive, obscene, or theologically unsound. As virtually the whole of A Caution for Young Girls is obscene, it was not like to have been transcribed by either maesters or septons. Given the number of copies known to exist, hundreds, though as many more were burned by Baylor the Blessed, the scribes responsible were most likely septons expelled from the faith for drunkenness, theft, or fornication, failed students who left the Citadel without a chain, hired quills from the free cities, or mummers, the worst of all. Lacking the rigour of maesters, such scribes oft feel free to improve on the texts they are copying. Mummers in particular are prone to this. In the case of A Caution for Young Girls, such improvements largely consisted of adding ever more episodes of depravity and changing the existing episodes to make them even more disturbing and lascivious. As alteration followed alteration over the years, it became ever more difficult to ascertain which was the original text, to the extent that even maesters at the Citadel cannot agree as to the title of the book, as has been noted. The identity of the man who met Corianne Wilde in the inn by the ferry, if indeed such a meeting ever took place, is another matter of contention. In the copies entitled Sins of the Flesh and The High and the Low, which tend to be the older versions and the shortest, the man at the inn is identified as Sir Boris Baratheon, eldest of Lord Rogar's four brothers. In A Wanton's Tale and The Wickedness of Men, however, the man is Lord Rogar himself. All these versions agree on what happened next. Dismissing Lady Corianne's father and brother, the lord commanded the girl to disrobe, so he might inspect her. "He ran his hands over every part of me," she wrote, "and bade me turn this way and that, and bend and stretch and open my legs to his gaze, until at last he pronounced himself satisfied." Only then did the man reveal the purpose of the summons that had brought her to King's Landing. She was to be sent to Dragonstone, a supposed maid, to serve as one of Queen Alysanne's companions, but once there, she was to use her wiles and her body to beguile the king into bed. "Jaehaerys is a man-made, like as not, and besotted with his sister," this man supposedly told her. "But Alysanne is but a child, and you are a woman any man would want. Once his grace tastes your charms, he may come to his senses and abandon this folly of a marriage. He may even choose to keep you afterward, who can say? There can be no question of marriage, of course, but you would have jewels, servants, whatever you might want. There are rich rewards in being a king's bedwarmer. If Alysanne should discover you abed together, so much the better. She is a prideful girl and would be quick to abandon an unfaithful spouse, and if you should get with child again, you and the babe would be well taken care of, and your father and mother will be richly rewarded for your service to the crown." Certain copies of A Wanton's Tale include an additional amorous episode, wherein Lord Rogar himself has carnal knowledge of the girl all through the night. But these are almost certainly a later addition by some lustful scribe or depraved pander. Can we put any credence in this tale? At this late date, so far removed from the events in question, with all the principals long dead, there is no way to be certain. Beyond the testimony of the girl herself, we have no source to verify that this meeting by the ferry ever took place. And if some Baratheon did indeed meet privily with Corianne Wilde before she reached King's Landing, we cannot know what words he might have spoken to her. He could as easily have simply been instructing her in her duties as a spy and tattle, as the other girls had been instructed. Archmaester Cray, writing at the Citadel in the last years of King Jaehaerys's long reign, believed that the meeting at the inn was a clumsy calumny intended to blacken the name of Lord Rogar, and went so far as to attribute the lie to Sir Boris Baratheon himself, who quarrelled bitterly with his brother in later life. Other scholars, including Maester Ryburn, the Citadel's foremost expert on banned, forbidden, fraudulent and obscene texts, put the story down as no more than a bawdy tale of the sort known to excite the lust of young boys, bastards, whores, and the men who partake of their favours. Amongst the small folk there are always men of a lascivious character who delight in tales of great lords and noble knights despoiling maidens, Ryburn wrote. For this persuades them that their betters share their own base lusts. Mayhaps. Yet there are certain things that we do know beyond a doubt that may allow us to draw our own conclusions. We do know that the younger daughter of Morgan Wilde, Lord of the Rainhouse, was deflowered at an early age and gave birth to a bastard boy. We can be reasonably certain that Lord Rogar knew of her shame. Not only was he Lord Morgan's liege, but the child was placed in his own household. We know that Corianne Wilde was amongst the maids who were sent to Dragonstone as companions for Queen Alysanne. A singularly curious choice, if a lady-in-waiting was all she was meant to be, for scores of other young girls of noble birth and suitable age were also available, girls whose maidenheads were intact, and whose virtue was beyond reproach. Why her, many have asked in the years since. Did she have some special gift, some particular charm? If so, no one remarked on it at the time. Could Lord Rogar or Queen Alyssa have been indebted to her lord father or lady mother for some past favour or kindness? We have no record of it. No plausible explanation for the selection of Corianne Wilde has ever been offered, save for the simple, ugly answer proffered by A Caution for Young Girls. She was sent to Dragonstone not for Alysanne, but for Jaehaerys. It is said that many years later, when King Aegon IV was in his cups, someone raised the matter in his presence. His Grace supposedly laughed and stated his conviction that if Lord Rogar were no fool, he would have instructed all of the maidens sent to Dragonstone in 50 AC to bed the young king, since the hand could not have known which of them Jaehaerys would prefer. This infamous suggestion has taken root amongst the small folk, but it is unsupported by proof of any sort, and may be safely dismissed. Court records indicate that Septa Isabel, Lady Lucinda and the other women chosen for Alysanne Targaryen's household boarded the trading galley Wise Woman at dawn on the 7th day of the 2nd moon of 50 AC, and left for Dragonstone on the morning tide. Queen Alyssa had sent word of their coming ahead by Raven, yet even so she had some concern that the Wise Women, as they became known from that day forth, would find the gates of Dragonstone closed to them. Her fears were unfounded. The little queen and two Kingsguard met them at the harbour as they disembarked, and Alysanne welcomed each of them with glad smiles and gifts. Before we relate what happened afterward, let us turn our gaze briefly to Fair Isle, where Rhaena Targaryen, the Queen in the West, resided with her new husband and a court of her own. It will be recalled that Queen Alyssa had been no more pleased by her eldest daughter's third marriage than by the one her son would soon make, though Rhaena's marriage was of less consequence. She was not alone in this, for in truth, Andro Farman was a curious choice for one with the blood of the dragon in her veins. The second son of Lord Farman, not even the heir, Andro was said to be a handsome boy with pale blue eyes and long flaxen hair, but he was 9 years younger than the queen and even at his own father's court, There were those who scorned him as half a girl himself, for he was soft of speech and gentle of nature. A singular failure as a squire, he had never become a knight, having none of the martial skills of his lord father and elder brother. For a time his sire had considered sending him to Old Town to forge a maester's chain, until his own maester told him that the boy was simply not clever enough, and could hardly read nor write. Later, when asked why she had chosen such an unpromising spouse, Rhaena Targaryen replied, "He was kind to me." Andro's father had been kind to her as well, offering her refuge on Fair Isle after the battle beneath the God's Eye, when her uncle, King Maegor, was demanding her capture, and the poor fellows of the realm were denouncing her as a vile sinner and her daughters as abominations. Some have put forward the suggestion that the widowed queen took Andro for her husband in part to repay his father for that kindness, for Lord Farman, himself a second son, who had never expected to rule, was known to have great fondness for Andro, despite his deficiencies. Mayhaps there is some truth in that assertion, but another possibility, first put forward by Lord Farman's maester, may cut closer to the bone. "The queen found her true love on Fair Isle," Maester Smike wrote to the Citadel, "not with Andro, but with his sister, Lady Elissa." 3 years Andro's elder, Elissa Farman shared her brother's blue eyes and long flaxen hair, but elsewise she was as unlike him as a sibling could be. Sharp of wit and sharper of tongue, she loved horses, dogs, and hawks. She was a fine singer and a skilled archer, but her great love was sailing. "The wind our steed," were the words of the Farmans of Fair Isle, who had sailed the western seas since the Dawn Age, and Lady Elissa embodied them. As a child, it was said that she spent more time at sea than upon the land. Her father's crews used to laugh to see her climbing the rigging like a monkey. She sailed her own boat around Fair Isle at the age of 4 and 10, and by the time she was 20 she had voyaged as far north as Bear Island and as far south as the Arbor. Oft-times, to the horror of her lord father and lady mother, she spoke of her desire to take a ship beyond the western horizon, to learn what strange and wondrous lands might lie on the far side of the sunset sea. Lady Elissa had been twice betrothed, once at 12 and once at 16, but she had frightened off both boys, as her own father admitted ruefully. In Rhaena Targaryen, however, she found a like-minded companion, and in her the queen found a new confidant. Together with Elaine Royce and Samantha Stokeworth, two of Rhaena's oldest friends, they became nigh inseparable, a court within the court that Sir Franklin Farman, Lord Mark's elder son, dubbed the Four-Headed Beast. Andro Farman, Rhaena's new husband, was admitted to their circle from time to time, but never so often as to be taken for a fifth head. Most tellingly, Queen Rhaena never took him flying with her on the back of her dragon, Dreamfire, an adventure she shared frequently with the ladies Elissa, Elaine, and Sam. In fairness, it is more than possible that the queen invited Andro to share the sky with her, only to have him decline, for he was not of an adventurous disposition. It would be a mistake to regard Queen Rhaena's time at Fair Castle as an idyll, however. Not everyone welcomed her presence by any means. Even here, on this distant isle, there were poor fellows, angered that Lord Mark, like his father before him, had given support and sanctuary to one they regarded as an enemy of the faith. The continued presence of Dreamfire on the island was also creating problems. Glimpsed every few years, a dragon was a wonder and a terror to behold, and it was true that some of the Fair Islanders took pride in having a dragon of our own. Others, however, were made anxious by the presence of the great beast, especially as she grew larger and hungrier. Feeding a growing dragon is no small thing, and when it became known that Dreamfire had produced a clutch of dragon eggs, a begging brother from the inland hills began to preach that Fair Isle would soon be overrun by dragons, devouring sheep and cows and men alike, unless a dragon slayer came forth to put an end to the scourge. Lord Farman sent forth knights to seize the man and silence him, but not before thousands had heard his prophecies. Though the preacher died in the dungeons under Fair Castle, his words lived on, filling the ignorant with fear wherever they were heard. Even within the walls of Lord Farman's own seat, Queen Rhaena had enemies, chief amongst them his lordship's heir. Sir Franklin had fought in the battle beneath the God's Eye and taken a wound there, blood shed in the service of Prince Aegon the Uncrowned. His grandsire had died upon that battlefield, together with his eldest son, and it had been left to him to bring their corpses home to Fair Isle. Yet it seemed to him that Rhaena Targaryen showed little remorse for all the grief she had brought to House Farman, and little gratitude to him personally. He also resented her friendship with his sister, Alyssa. Instead of encouraging her in what he regarded as her wild, willful ways, Sir Franklin thought the Queen should be enjoining her to do her duty to her house by making an appropriate marriage and producing children. Nor did he appreciate the manner in which the four-headed beast had somehow become the centre of court life at Fair Castle, whilst his lord father and himself were increasingly disregarded. In that, he was well justified. More and more high-born lords from the Westerlands and beyond were visiting Fair Isle, Maester Smike noted, but when they came, it was to have audience with the Queen in the West, not with a minor lordling of a small isle and his son. None of this was of great concern to the Queen and her familiars, so long as Mark Farman ruled in Faircastle, for his lordship was an amiable and good-natured man who loved all his children, his wayward daughter and weakling son included, and loved Rhaena Targaryen for loving them as well. Less than a fortnight after the Queen and Andro Farman had celebrated the first anniversary of their union, however, Lord Mark died suddenly at his own table, choking to death upon a fishbone at the age of 46. And with his passing, Sir Franklin became the Lord of Fair Isle. He wasted little time. On the day after his father's funeral, he summoned Rhaena to his great hall. He would not deign to go to her, and commanded her to remove herself from his island. "You are not wanted here," he told her. "You are not welcome here. Take your dragon with you, and your friends, and my little brother, who would surely piss his breeches if he were made to stay. But do not presume to take my sister. She will remain here, and she will be wed to a man of my choosing." Franklin Farman did not lack for courage, as Maester Smike wrote in a letter to the Citadel. He did lack for sense, however, and in that moment he did not seem to realize how close he stood to death. "I could see the fire in her eyes," the Maester said, "and for a moment I could see Fair Castle burning, the white towers blackening and collapsing into the sea as flames leapt from every window, and the dragon wheeled about again and again." Rhaena Targaryen was the blood of the dragon, and far too proud to linger long where she was not wanted. She departed Fair Isle that very night, taking wing for Casterly Rock upon Dreamfire, after instructing her husband and companions to follow her by ship, "with all those who might love me." When Andro, flushed with anger, offered to face his brother in single combat, the Queen quickly dissuaded him. "He would cut you to pieces, my love," she told him, "and were I to be thrice widowed, men would name me a witch, or worse, and hound me from Westeros." Lyman Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock, had sheltered her before, she reminded him. Queen Rhaena was confident that he would welcome her again. Andro Farman, Samantha Stokeworth, and Elaine Royce set out to follow the next morning, together with more than 40 of the Queen's friends, servants, and hangers-on, for Her Grace had gathered a sizable coterie about her as the Queen in the West. Lady Alyssa was with them as well, for she had no intention of remaining behind. Her ship, the Maiden's Fancy, had been made ready for the crossing. When the Queen's party reached the docks, however, they found Sir Franklin waiting for them. The rest of them could go, and good riddance, he announced, but his sister would remain on Fair Isle to be wed. The new lord had brought only half a dozen men with him, however, and he had seriously misjudged the love the small folk bore his sister, particularly the sailors, shipwrights, fisherfolk, porters, and other denizens of the dockside districts, many of whom had known her since she was a small girl. As Lady Alyssa confronted her brother, spitting defiance at him and demanding that he get out of her way, a crowd gathered around them, growing angrier by the moment. Oblivious to their mood, his lordship attempted to seize his sister, whereupon the onlookers rushed forward, overwhelming his men before they could draw their blades. Three of them were shoved off the docks into the water, whilst Lord Franklin himself was thrown into a ship's hold full of fresh-caught cod. Alyssa Farman and the rest of the Queen's friends boarded Maiden's Fancy untouched and set sail for Lannisport. Lyman Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock, had given Rhaenyra and her husband Aegon the Uncrowned refuge when Maegor the Cruel was demanding their heads. His bastard son, Sir Tyler Hill, had fought with Prince Aegon under the God's Eye. His wife, the formidable Lady Jocasta of House Tarbeck, had befriended Rhaenyra during her time at the Rock, and had been the first to discern that she was with child. Just as the Queen had expected, they welcomed her now, and when the rest of her party landed in Lannisport, the Lannisters took them in as well. A lavish feast was held in their honour, an entire stable was given over to Dreamfire, and Queen Rhaenyra, her husband, and her companions of the Four-Headed Beast were assigned a regally appointed suite of apartments deep in the bowels of the Rock itself, safe from any harm. There they lingered for more than a moon's turn, enjoying the hospitality of the wealthiest house in all of Westeros. As the days passed, however, that very hospitality grew ever more disquieting to Rhaenyra Targaryen. It became apparent to her that the bedmaids and servants assigned to them were tattlers and spies, bringing word of their every doing back to Lord and Lady Lannister. One of the castle septers asked Samantha Stokeworth whether the Queen's marriage to Andrew Farman had ever been consummated, and if so, who had witnessed the bedding? Sir Tyler Hill, Lord Lyman's comely bastard son, was openly scornful of Andrew, even whilst doing all he could to ingratiate himself to Rhaenyra herself, regaling her with tales of his exploits at the battle beneath the God's Eye, and showing her the scars he had taken there in your Aegon's service. Lord Lyman himself began to express an unseemly interest in the three dragon eggs that the Queen had brought from Fair Isle, wondering how and when they might be expected to hatch. His wife, Lady Jocasta, suggested privately that one or more of the eggs would make a fine gift, if Her Grace should wish to show her gratitude to House Lannister for taking her in. When that ploy proved unsuccessful, Lord Lyman offered to buy the eggs outright for a staggering sum of gold. The Lord of Casterly Rock wanted more than just a high-born guest, Queen Rhaenyra realized then. Beneath the warmth of his veneer, he was too cunning and too ambitious to settle for so little. He wanted an alliance with the Iron Throne, possibly through marriage between her and his bastard, or one of his true-born sons. Some union that would raise the Lannisters up past the Hightowers, the Baratheons, and the Valyrians to be the second house in the realm. And he wanted dragons. With dragon riders of their own, the Lannisters would be the equals of the Targaryens. They were kings once, she reminded Sam Stokeworth. He smiles, but he was raised on tales of the Field of Fire. He will not have forgotten. Rhaenyra Targaryen knew her history as well, the history of the Freehold of Valyria, writ in blood and fire. We cannot remain here, she confided to her dear companions. There, we must leave Queen Rhaenyra for a time, whilst we cast our eyes eastward again toward King's Landing and Dragonstone, where the regent and king remained at odds. Vexing as the issue of the king's marriage was to Queen Alyssa and Lord Rhaegar, it must not be thought that it was the only matter that concerned them during their regency. Coin, or rather the lack of coin, was the crown's most pressing problem. King Maegor's wars had been ruinously expensive, exhausting the royal treasury. To refill his coffers, Maegor's master of coin had raised existing taxes and imposed new ones, but these measures brought in less gold than anticipated and only served to deepen the anathema with which the lords of the realm regarded the king. Nor had the situation improved with the ascension of Jaehaerys. The young prince's coronation and his mother's golden wedding had both been splendid affairs that had done much to win him the love of lords and small folk alike, but all that had come at a cost. An even larger expense loomed ahead. Lord Rhaegar was determined to complete work on the Dragon Pit before handing the city and the kingdom over to Jaehaerys, but the funds were lacking. Edwell Celtigar, Lord of Claw Isle, had been an ineffectual hand for Maegor the Cruel. Given a second chance under the regency, he proved to be an equally ineffectual master of coin. Unwilling to offend his fellow lords, Celtigar instead decided to impose new taxes on the small folk of King's Landing, who were conveniently close at hand.